This is Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Baba. January 28, 1986 was a difficult day in American history. It was the day of the Challenger explosion, and was also right in the middle of the AIDS epidemic that swept the country. It's over the course of that one day that Elaine Magree unfolds her story in the one-woman show Holding the Edge. In it, she shares her own experiences of being a hospice nurse in Oakland during that era, and how she tried to balance motherhood, political activism, sobriety, and faith in the goodness of the world. Magree talked to KALW's Jen Chien about putting her own life on the stage.
In the show, you talk about the difference between Nurse Elaine and Plain Elaine. Can you explain that difference for people who haven't seen your show?
Sure. Like anyone, when you're at work, there may be a slightly different persona that you live in while at work. You probably don't say every single thing to your people you work with that you might say to a friend. So I think people in healthcare have to develop a persona that's both authentic, competent, but you can't say every single thing. Like, if you were with a friend and you encountered a bad smell, you'd probably say, oh God, that smells horrible. But you don't do that professionally. There's also moderating your degree of emotional engagement. As Plain Elaine, as myself or yourself, we might engage emotionally in something wholeheartedly. A sad situation might make us weep.
But this seems especially relevant if you're a hospice nurse, which is sad. People are dying.
That's
their
right.
Family members are sad around you.
That's right. That's right. And while it's just so tricky to be open to feeling the reality of the situation, but at the same time not go into the depth of emotion that you might have, because your job is to kind of hold the container for everyone else, as well as add the spices and stir.
Crying doesn't get the job done, but not detached or disconnected either. That's so isolating for people. They're like, how can you just be talking normally when my whole world is coming to an end? So when I can, the middle way. I open up a channel between me and the other person, and everything else goes soft focus and drifts away. There's just what you need and how I can give it to you.
Your show deals with a lot of dark subjects. So there's death, as we talked about. There's the kind of large tragedy of the AIDS epidemic. There's the Challenger disaster that happens on the day that the show takes place. There's also a whole lot of humor. There's a lot of laughter. So can you talk about the balance between those two things in your experience of the events in your own past, and then how you thought about bringing that balance to the stage?
I think because, in particular, the show is rooted in what we called gay culture, now we would probably call queer culture. I think that camp is a survival tool of queer culture that men developed, that of taking things that were used to shame us and turning them around and making them strengths and flaunting them. And I really tried to capture that spirit throughout the piece. Some of it is a love letter to that aspect of gay male culture.
So, dying with AIDS, it'll be from an infection. And it'll be pretty quick. 2 years, 5 hospitals, that's not quick. You're right, Elsie, of course. Do you have any fears? Oh, yeah, of being left out. And that the afterlife nuns have no glitter.
Everyone I'm close to, I tend to be close to people who are irreverent and who cope by making jokes. When my father died, he was in his 90s. He'd had a long, wonderful life, and we were all gathered in his room in a nursing home, and he'd gone on longer than anyone expected. Two of my brothers were there, my son was there, his wife was there, and my brother went out of the room to get a soda, and while he was out of the room, my father died. And I knew, I was watching and other people were talking, and when he came back in the room, I kind of gave him what we used to call the hairy eyeball. I stared at him, and then I looked at my dad, and I looked at him, and I looked at my dad, and he got it, and he held up his Coke and said, things go better with Coke. And that,
oh my goodness.
that's my family.
Yeah.
I grew up with humor as a coping mechanism, and it was completely appropriate for how everyone was feeling at the time. And I've just always been drawn to that. And when I first started, the second part of your question was how did I bring that in? When I first started working on the piece, I was in a little writing group, and they were fascinated by all the details of what happened at a death. And they kept saying, tell me more, tell me more. And it was getting longer and longer and longer describing all these details. And when I first brought it into our writing group, our mentor, David Ford, who's a brilliant developer of solo theater, said, you have to have some other colors in there. You just can't go on kind of like that.
Even if it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It was just bringing you down and down?
It was monotone in a certain kind of way. And then that's when I started working on several different threads that I could weave in that would make it funnier. I think it's also true that when people laugh, there's something that opens up and you're more willing to listen. And then when you go into a deep place, you're more willing or more need laugh as a release. So going back and forth between those two has been really fascinating in this piece.
You have a thing in the show about saying sorry, about how when you said I'm sorry to your patients as a hospice nurse, that it took the focus off of them and onto yourself in a way that didn't feel right to you.
People are so generous. I can tell somebody about their impending death, and if I say sorry, they take care of me. Like, oh dear, it's not your fault. So I'm trying not to say that anymore.
Can you just talk about that a little bit for folks who haven't seen the show?
I've noticed with patients and in other situations, sometimes when people say, I'm sorry, they're saying, please forgive me. Really, there's an underlying, I feel so upset, I don't know what to do, I'm going to say I'm sorry. And sometimes it does put the other person in a situation of trying to take care of them. And I wanted to be really clear as a healthcare provider that almost never did I want someone to have to take care of me. There were very, very few occasions where it became clear that a patient or family needed to give me a gift in order to keep the balance of energy and to be comfortable. And even though we weren't allowed to receive gifts, people would want to give you a bag of lemons. At that time, we agreed we would accept them because it was really for them more than for us. But mostly saying sorry to people diverts them from what they're experiencing and makes them think about, do I say, it's not your fault, or, oh, don't worry about it, or it requires a response. So I just started not saying that and finding other things to try and say with people. But I also acknowledge in the play, it's a totally human thing to say, and people say it for the very best reasons. And I don't want to criticize anyone. It was just something I found in my work. And I decided to leave it in the play. And it's resonated with a lot of people. But I do, you know, clearly say it's just human to say you're sorry.